Talk Up the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. My doctor told me not to go into medicine. He has a son who is also a doctor, but conducts laboratory research instead of seeing patients. My doctor dropped all health insurance coverage, saying that when he was asked to withhold medication for some of his cancer patients because the health insurance would not cover it, that was the last straw. He apologized for dropping the coverage because he knew it would cost me a lot of money out of pocket, but he said that if he wanted to remain a good doctor, he needed to spend more than 15 minutes with his patients. My doctor's physicals take about 2 hours. In a recent study of physician satisfaction, doctors said maintaining clinical autonomy, being able to treat their patients the way they felt was necessary, was more important than income in determining how happy they were on the job. But physicians are facing financial problems. Doctors in New Jersey walked off their jobs this week, refusing to see patients except those needing urgent care, because they say they can't afford to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on medical malpractice insurance. They are not alone. Doctors in other states report the same problem, and some of them have left their families to practice in other states where the insurance is just a fraction of what they were paying. This hour, we're going to talk with doctors about the changing nature of medical practice and how that's affecting them. Are you a doctor, a med student? Are you thinking about becoming a doctor? Are you unhappy being a doctor and have suggestions you'd like to offer for fixing it? Give us a call. Or do you think that being a doctor is a great occupation and you are greatly satisfied? We'd like to hear from you, too. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. And if you want more information about our topic today, go over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Dr. David Blumenthal is a physician and director of the Institute for Health Policy at the Mass General Hospital Partners Healthcare System. He's also professor of medicine and professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Med School in Boston. He joins us today by phone from Florida. Welcome to the program, Dr. Blumenthal.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Dr. Jamie Wiseman is the author of As I Live and Breathe, Notes of a Patient Doctor, published last year from North Point Press. She's a private practice dermatologist in Austell, Georgia, and she joins us today from her office there. Welcome to the program, Dr. Wiseman.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Blumenthal, the story of my doctor, is it a familiar one?
It's a familiar one. We certainly hear about that and read about it constantly in the press these days.
Same with you, Dr. Wiseman?
It's happening. I think it's happening more in some specialties than in others, but definitely not an unfamiliar story.
While we patients are certainly familiar with some of them, describe the changes, Dr. Blumenthal, in the medical practice that doctors have experienced in the last several years.
I think physicians are now experiencing much more intrusion on those areas of clinical autonomy that you mentioned in the study you cited. There are more times when they're forced to change the medications that they've chosen for patients. There are more times when their patients have very strong opinions about what the patients themselves want because of advertising or something that they've learned on the Internet. There are more times when they are urged by their hospital administrators to move patients through there more rapidly in the hospital to get them out sooner, to open up beds and cut costs. And there are more times when they are told that particular things that they want to do with patients are not affordable or not covered under insurance. So that last part has, in the last year or two, probably declined somewhat.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Wiseman, you're a young doctor early in your medical career. Is this what you expected it to be?
Well, certainly managed care was already a fact when I went into medical school. And since I'd been a patient and since my father's a physician, I sort of knew what I was getting myself into. So I never knew the days when you could just do whatever you wanted to do or write for whatever prescription you wanted to write for and nobody was looking over your shoulder. So I guess I'm used to it. I'm used to arguing with insurance companies when I have to, and I'm used to working within the constraints of a managed care system.
Did your dad encourage you to pursue a career in medicine?
Well, actually, it's funny. When I decided to go to medical school, I was in the hospital with my father, and my father introduced me to a colleague of his and said, I'm so proud Jamie's going to medical school. And he said, how did you let your child go to medical school? And my father said, I still think it's one of the best things you can do with your life. It may not be as easy or may not be as rewarding as it once was, though I didn't practice in those days, but he still thought it was a wonderful thing to do with your life. And I agree. I'm very happy.
Mm-hmm. Ira, if I could just...
Sure.
There are things that we can do. I've been seeing patients for 30 years. I can help my patients in ways now that I never could 30 years ago. There are diseases, cardiovascular disease, heart attacks being one, arthritis another, where we can make big differences in people's lives. That's a very gratifying side to medicine, which I don't think we should lose track of in all the discussion about the administrative and financial problems.
Mm-hmm. What would you do to fix it? I mean, in practical terms, you've been a physician 30 years. Is there a solution?
Well, there are going to have to be lots of solutions, and none of them is going to be easy. And your program might have to be longer than it is for us to fully air all the
Well, give me the top 20,000.
Yeah. I think one of the most important things we have to do is make sure that everyone has health insurance, because a lot of the trouble that physicians get into right now and have good health insurance, a lot of the trouble that physicians get into right now has to do with situations where patients can't afford things that they need. And one particular aspect of that, for example, is prescription drugs among the elderly. I think physicians also are going to increasingly find themselves in healthcare organizations that can help them deal with the outside world and give them some security and some predictability in their lives, and also can negotiate better with insurance companies for a livable payment schedules. So those are two of the solutions that I think are coming down the line.
Dr. Wiseman, any suggestions on your side?
Well, I think health insurance is a huge issue, and I think it's only getting worse in recent years. Certainly, as a patient, I know that to be true. I think doctors have to take a little bit of responsibility for where we find ourselves. I'm constantly spending part of my day educating patients on why I'm not giving them an expensive drug that they saw advertised. Just recently, we had one of the pharmaceutical representatives in, and she said, "Do you use my medication?" And I said, "No, there's a generic version that's just as good. You know, maybe marginally they get a little more stomach upset. I tell them to take it with a full meal. They're fine." I mean, we have to take the responsibility for saying there are areas where we can save money and we need to be responsible. One thing that's a big issue, I think, for doctors, I'm a dermatologist, so I'm in a field that does a lot of procedures. And we have lost the ability to set our reimbursement schedules. So I am watching physicians who I have a tremendous amount of respect for who are in the fields that are more thinking-oriented. Certainly Dr. Blumenthal's field of internal medicine is one of them. And they don't, for some reason, get reimbursed at the same rate as someone who goes in and does something. So somehow, because of these third-party payers, I think it's wound up that in medicine you get paid for doing and not for thinking. And I agree with Dr. Blumenthal, if we somehow reorganize and take a little responsibility for how these reimbursement schedules are set, if we can figure out how to do that, I think things could be a little more just. There are some doctors who are making an enormous amount of money in the managed care environment, and I think that is because they may be working in fields that, for some reason, are now disproportionately reimbursed, whereas other fields are really hurting.
Such as?
I think the fields that are hurting are internal medicine, pediatrics, obstetrics, and I think some of the fields that are doing extraordinarily well are anesthesia, radiology, my field, dermatology. And, you know, I just finished my residency, and I can tell you, those are the fields where it's very, very hard to get a residency position, because certainly people are looking around and saying, I've worked really hard through my 4 years of medical school. I've got a mountain of debt. I've worked really hard through my 3, 5, 7, whatever years of postgraduate training. And, you know, I think I deserve to make more money than a physician's assistant. And in some fields, the physician assistant can make more money than the physician.
Mm-hmm.
Because the physician assistant has gone into a field that's very procedure-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Blumenthal,
I read
your study, and I was very interested. The other thing, I'm sorry to interject this, but I was in medical school during the big dot-com years, and that was a big issue, watching all of your friends get rich while you were had a very delayed gratification for your career.
Well, Dr. Blumenthal, share your study with the rest of us.
Well, we studied, along with some of my colleagues and a group in Washington called the Center for the Study of Health System Change, we studied physicians and their satisfaction over about a four-year period. We surveyed a nationally representative sample of physicians in 1997, then 1999, and then again in 2001. And a couple of salient points. First of all, 80% of the physicians in pretty much all 3 years said that they were very satisfied or satisfied with their careers. So it didn't seem as though large numbers of practicing physicians were dissatisfied. There was some decline in the number of physicians who were very satisfied between 1997 and 1999, but not much change between 99 and 2001. I think that what we're seeing is that there was, during the height of the managed care era in the last decade, a considerable erosion of physician contentment with their work, but that has begun to turn around now because managed care is a much less important or limiting factor on physicians than it was just a few years ago. Matter of fact, specialists in particular are reporting that their level of clinical autonomy is increasing, and that is very directly related, I think, to the reduction in managed care controls. But as you pointed out in your introduction, Ira, one of the things that we did see was that clinical autonomy and control over work were probably the most important influences on how satisfied physicians are and whether their satisfaction increased or decreased. More important, as you pointed out, than income, though income clearly does matter.
Uh-huh. So you think it's leveled off now, the satisfaction?
I think that until this malpractice crisis hit, things were getting better. I think that this malpractice issue will again adversely affect physicians' level of contentment with their work. These cycles occur every so often on a fairly regular basis, and for reasons that are difficult to understand, and I think this one will pass too. I don't think we're out of the woods because I think the healthcare system has deep and lasting problems that physicians will share with their patients and with all the people who participate in this sector of society, and they're going to come back to haunt us in one way or another as time goes forward.
Mm-hmm. So you think that this malpractice is a real problem, and it's a real scream by doctors now for attention?
Well, just as things were beginning to get a little better, especially for specialists, they suddenly got these enormous increases in their malpractice premiums. And as you know, there's controversy about whether it's the result of increasing awards by juries or increasing number of suits, or whether it's because there's consolidation in the insurance industry with sort of a cartel charging higher prices, or whether it's because the investment portfolios of the insurance industries have done less well. And I don't know the answer to which is most important, but whatever it is, it's hit physicians very hard, and I think coming on top of a long struggle with what they perceive to be reduced autonomy and increased intrusion has sort of tipped them over into in some cases, almost hysteria.
Yeah, because it's sort of snowballing around the country,
mm-hmm.
one state after the other, the Hippocratic Oath and everything. When doctors go on strike, it's a shocking thing to see.
Yep.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We're talking about do you want to be a doctor and the pitfalls and practices of doctors with Dr. David Blumenthal, who is at Mass General Hospital and professor of medicine and professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Med School in Boston. Dr. Jamie Wiseman, who is author of As I Live and Breathe, Notes of a Patient Doctor, published last year by North Point Press. She's also a practicing dermatologist in Austell, Georgia. So let's go to the phones. Lots of people want to talk about medicine, as you can imagine. Kelly in San Antonio. Hi, Kelly. Yep. Did we lose Kelly? I guess we lost Kelly. Let's try Alexandra in Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Alexandra.
Hello.
Hi. Yes, go ahead.
Yes. I had a question. I'm a graduate student at Duke University, and I'm taking a couple of courses in health policies. And from that, as well as from my readings, I know that the United States has one of the most expensive healthcare systems in the world, but not among the best in terms of performance. And one of the most striking examples of that is the fact that there's 40 million uninsured in America. And what share a responsibility? Would doctors themselves acknowledge for this situation as a group?
Dr. Blumenthal?
Well, it's hard for anyone to speak for all the doctors of our country. I do think that historically, physicians have not covered themselves with glory in the area of advocating or not advocating for universal coverage. I think physicians have changed to some degree. There are important organizations now that are on record advocating for that policy. But there were long periods of time when American physicians were opposed, and I suspect many remain opposed to that. And I don't think that is something that we can be proud of. Going forward, I would hope that that would change.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get Kelly in San Antonio back on the line. Kelly.
Hi.
Hi there.
I am so happy to finally talk to you. I am a medical student in San Antonio, and my father is a physician, and I just wanted to comment that the changes in medicine did not lead him to discourage me from medicine, although some of his colleagues tried to.
So what did they we can't let you get away with that. What did they tell you?
Oh, they said it's so much work for not enough payoff. And I think that what this change in medicine is leading to, and the change is something that my colleagues in school, my contemporaries, don't think of as a negative thing necessarily. And I think it's also leading to the next generation of physicians possibly being comprised of a group of people who have maybe a different skill set than my father's generation, more people skills, more fiscal skills. Since they know that they won't be operating in a vacuum. They're going to have contact with business, you know, business people, and they're going to have to consider their patient's economic status as well as their health status.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, his colleagues definitely, some of them, not to say that they're misanthropic, but I think that they just really thought that they were going to be much less economically stressed themselves than they are. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the genesis of their discontent.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that my dad also does not like fighting with insurance companies on the phone to try to get the care that he wants for his patients, but I think that our generation is definitely prepared for that if that does happen in our lives.
So you've gone through boot camp then for how to be a doctor these days.
Yes. and our teachers, when we're sitting in class, our teachers talk about these things with us. You know, this drug is expensive. You need to consider that when you're prescribing it because there's another drug that can work basically the same or even if it has a different mechanism of action, it can help your patients and they can afford it and it will improve their lives and they will be happy and healthy and, you know, and they'll come back and see you. They won't be disappointed or discouraged because the treatment plan that you've prescribed is not possible for them financially. And that is going to lead to better communication, I think, between doctors and their patients.
I'm sorry to interrupt. What did they tell you to do when your patients come in and they've watched the evening newscasts, which are just loaded with drug ads?
Yes.
To ask your doctor about Nexium, whatever, that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh. Our pharmacology teacher jokes about those ads all the time. You know, they just said, be ready. Your patients are going to ask you about them, and you need to know about them. So we're learning about the new drugs. And be ready to explain to the patient that, you know, these are advertisements. They're trying to sell you something. So, mm-hmm. of course, they're going to, you know, de-emphasize the negative and emphasize the positive. And as the doctor, hopefully doctors will remain impartial and be able to discuss the pros and cons of the drugs with their patients and will somehow get educated on the drugs, not just through the drug reps, but independently, which is sort of a problem, I think, in medicine today. So,
mm-hmm. Dr. Wiseman, you've heard this med student. She was talking about, the people skills. Kelly was saying that she's learning more people skills. You mentioned in your book that that you were taught by one of your doctors that the most important part of any examination was taking the pulse.
That was my dad, actually.
Was it your dad? Yeah. Well, there you go. Even
He's
better.
An excellent doctor.
Yeah.
I think that's very true. But I think for you know, historically, the doctor-patient alliance has always been the key to getting better, no matter what. If you don't have that, no matter how many drugs and surgical procedures you do, it's going to be hard to get your patient better. They have mm-hmm. to trust you. And I think Kelly's really on the ball there. I mean, you do have to talk to your patients. I'm a dermatologist. Patients come in all the time asking for miracle things. You know, they want to get rid of their toenail fungus. They see those ads. And I have to explain to them why this is or is not appropriate. And we talk together about what the best treatment is. And we have to be realistic in their expectations. But if you form that doctor-patient alliance, most patients will listen. And I think that that's relevant for a lot of things. For one thing, I think, to me, that's the absolute most satisfying thing about being a doctor is my relationship with my patients. If I didn't have that, I always wanted to be a doctor who saw patients. If I didn't have that, I think the day would just be would drag. It's fun to talk to people and get to know who they are, and to feel their trust in you is such a privilege.
Yeah.
It's really the most thrilling part of my day when someone, you know, when I know that someone is putting their trust in me. And I think that that has a lot to do with all of our problems, the sense that there was a lot of sense for a while with managed care and supposed gag rules that maybe we weren't telling all our patients what they needed to know, and there was loss of trust there. With the big malpractice issues, the fear that maybe your patient, you know, who's standing with you today may be sitting across the courtroom from you tomorrow, unfortunately, has gotten in the way of the doctor-patient relationship. But I think that for the most part, if you're honest with patients, even when there are bad outcomes, and there sometimes are bad outcomes, I mean, I've only been practicing 6 months, and not everything has gone perfectly, the patient usually will work with you if they feel that you're on their side and you're doing the best you can, honestly working as hard as you can.
Kelly, you know, we used to hear that doctors were never taught anything about nutrition.
Yeah.
In medical school. Are they teaching nutrition these days?
Actually, not a lot of nutrition. We did have an elective last semester that we didn't have to take, but we could take about nutrition. And then during the module where we learned about the stomach and the intestines, they talked to us about nutrition, especially for children. So there is a little bit. And being in South Texas, we hear a lot about diabetes and
right.
nutrition and obesity and lipids and all that. So we hear it. We hear about diabetes almost every day, especially with respect to nutrition. So,
do you also field questions about, hey, you know, they're doing this thing in Europe now.
Uh-huh.
Why can't we do that here? Yeah, questions like that. And let me bring my other doctors in. Dr. Blumenthal, what do you say to patients? You know, we see on TV, I saw one last night for some fat melting technique using injections that's sort of catching on in different places that comes from Europe. What do you tell patients when they come in hearing not just these things on TV about medications, but new techniques that are tried someplace else?
Well, first of all, let me just say that I am delighted to hear Kelly's attitude and Dr. Weissman's attitude, because I think that they may represent a younger generation of physicians who are much more at home with the changes that have been occurring over the last 10 to 20 years. Transitions are extremely hard, and change is extremely hard for anyone. And doctors in their 40s and 50s and 60s have had to change in ways that they didn't expect. And I think it's not uncommon in that situation to hear a lot of complaining and dissatisfaction. I do think that the kinds of attitudes that are exemplified in their responses are precisely the right ones. Patients are not objects, they are part of an alliance, and their needs and wishes and attitudes need to be absolutely critical to decision making. When patients come in with questions that they've learned about, and I hear as much about from the internet, matter of fact, I think it's unusual when my patients don't come in with some internet-based information about whatever symptom that they may be bringing in, or with some drug in mind, often not verbalized, but you can get a feeling that there's some question in the background that they may not be willing to come right out with. I think all that you can do is be honest. If you know what they are referring to and have some information about it, share that and let them understand as well as they can what's known about it. I have a computer on my desk, and I will go online with patients looking for information about something that they may have questions about. And I think that is going mm-hmm. to be a increasingly important skill, or at least attitude, for physicians to be able to help their patients find information together or find information independently of them. Mm-hmm. Physicians no longer have the kind of monopoly over the facts that they once had, and can't be expected to know everything. Sometimes they hear only at the same times that their patients do about new studies, and cannot really know more than their patients know.
So what would, if you had one bit of advice before we say goodbye to Kelly here as a med student, what would you say to her?
I would say keep listening to your patients, don't be ashamed if you don't know something. Admit it and try to learn it.
Okay, Kelly?
Thank you so much.
Good luck. Have you decided on a specialty yet?
Well, my dad's an ophthalmologist, so he puts the articles on my bed about how great ophthalmology is from time to time. So I'm not ruling out ophthalmology, but I love children, so maybe pediatrics.
Oh, that's terrific. All right, thanks a lot for
Thank
calling.
You.
And good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. 1-800-989-8255 was the number. Dr. Wiseman, do you have a model in life? Do you have a mentor or somebody you model yourself after that you might have learned from?
Oh, I absolutely do. And she's right there in New York. I came to medicine from a unique perspective. Not only was my father a doctor, but I have a congenital immune deficiency. And so I was a patient for many years before I finally decided to go to medical school. My immunologist is in New York. Her name is Charlotte Cunningham Rundle. She is the model for everything I do as a doctor. She is so compassionate, caring, always up to date, and really just understands that she and I are a team together trying to keep me healthy.
That whole family is. I know that. I know that name. I know.
Do you know that name? The whole family.
I know the name. I know the doctor's there. Yeah, it's so surprising to read it. You know, hear you say that, because I would agree with you.
Yeah, she. I mean, all of her patients feel this way, and she's not. I mean, I have had a lot of wonderful doctors, and I've had some doctors who are less than wonderful too, caring for me through the mm-hmm. years. But for more good than bad, I'm happy to say, and I learn from the good ones and the bad ones. But I've had, you know, whenever I think about what I'm doing as a physician, I bear in mind the things that have been done for me. And I'm constantly aware that I could easily be on the other side of this equation. Periodically, I'll hear about people doing things that I think maybe are not as ethical as I would like. And I think as you go through medicine, and actually my advice to Kelly would be, or any medical student, would be always think, is this the care I would like to be given or would like my loved one to be given? And since I've been on the other side of the equation at least as often as I've been the mm-hmm. one wearing the white coat, it's easy for me to think in those terms.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about medicine this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. But by modeling yourself after, let me put it this way, an old, experienced doctor, doesn't that create frustrations for you, knowing how they used to do things the way they wanted to and had more freedom?
Well, she's not old.
Well, I don't mean old. Old, I mean 10 years, you know, being in practice 10 or 15. I know she's been in practice 10 or 20 years. And I don't mean, you know, being old in chronological term.
Well, I think we've all had to adapt. And I think, you know, I have to say, when I was listening to your introduction and you said your doctor takes 2 hours to do mm-hmm. a physical, I think that's wonderful. One thing we've learned how to do is not do it in 2 hours and try and be just as thorough. And sometimes I'll have to explain to my patients that I simply can't spend the kind of time with them that I would like to, maybe chatting and doing the more leisurely parts of my job mm-hmm. because I have other patients waiting and I do have to see them. But I do not skip on the part of my job that is delivering health care. And there are certainly patients who, in some sense, when I look at my overhead costs, I may literally lose money on because they're complicated and I need more time with them, and sometimes you have to make that up because of managed care on other things that you do. But I think that I know that we've all had to adapt in some ways to that, and I think maybe it was, as you said, harder for, maybe Dr. Blumenthal alluded to this, harder for the doctors in their 40s and 50s who knew what life was like before. But it hasn't been frustrating for me. I think it's probably been mm-hmm. perhaps more frustrating for her. I just have a lot of respect for her because she has adapted, and she works in a field that is almost all thinking. And it's very hard for those doctors these days to make ends meet. The other day I wanted to refer a patient to a rheumatologist, and I couldn't get an appointment for her for 6 months. And it's because people aren't going into those fields that are really being squeezed by managed care. And that's going to be a problem for all of us, because we're not going to be able to get our patients in the proper care that we want them to have. And doctors, I think, are going to be a little bit responsible for saying we need to have a more egalitarian reimbursement schedule.
You think national health care is the way to go?
Well, now I'm really biased because I'm a member of Physicians for a National Health Care Plan.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I may not be representing.
Well, sell it. Sell it. Why national? No, give me your opinion. Why is national health care the way to go?
Well,
the arguments against it are, look, it doesn't work here. You have to do that here. Look at this bad experience in this country, that sort of thing.
Well, I think that patients need to take a little more, patients who are insured need to take a little more responsibility for their health care. And maybe what we need to have is some kind of what Medicare has, 80-20 reimbursement. So you do have some responsibility up to a certain level of care. So if you want the most expensive drug, you may have to pay a little more for that, so that there is a little bit of free market influence, and people are involved with that decision making on a pocketbook level. But I think that until everybody has access to health care, there is going to be an enormous disparity between the care that some people receive and the care that other people receive. And I think that the reimbursement disparities will even out. They certainly have in other countries. If we have a system like that, I think physicians will be more involved in the decision-making process ultimately.
All right. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. A brief program note on the next Talk of the Nation. Guest host Melinda Penkava talks with an American teacher who set up a book club in war-torn Kosovo and how it provided a forum not only for reading but also for healing. That's on the next Talk of the Nation. We're talking this hour about healing, about physician satisfaction, with my guest, Dr. David Blumenthal, physician and director of the Institute for Health Policy at Mass General Hospital, Partners Healthcare System, and professor of medicine and professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Med School in Boston. Dr. Jamie Weissman, private practice dermatologist in Austell, Georgia, author of As I Live and Breathe, Notes of a Patient Doctor, out last year from North Point Press. Our number, 1-800-989-8255 is our number. You studied medicine at Emory University, right, Dr. Weissman?
Yes, I did.
Did studying there give you any insights than it might have at any other place?
Well, it was kind of home for me. My father went there, and I came home. I was living in New York. I think Emory is an interesting place to study, and I trained there as well, because we have both a tertiary care hospital and then an inner city hospital, a veterans hospital. So you definitely have a cross-section of patients from all income levels and all background levels. Mm-hmm. And so I got to see patients who had very little access to healthcare system, to patients who were used to the highest level of healthcare. I think it's part of what influenced my opinions on changes that might be necessary in the healthcare system. Seeing also how academic physicians who really saw the most difficult cases, mm-hmm. had a hard time making ends meet, again, because what they were doing was so time-intensive, influenced to a great deal my opinions. Dr. Cunningham-Rendell's also, whenever I go to see her, I'm in there for at least an hour talking about what the latest discoveries are. She has a file that has my name on it with all the latest articles in it. There's no way to bill for that kind of time and attention, where you're reading the journals and pulling those articles out and Xeroxing them and putting them into a patient's file in the hope that this might one day be clinically relevant. There needs to be a way that those physicians who do that kind of work are recognized and rewarded appropriately.
Mm-hmm. I think there really do need to be some structural changes, and they might be easier to accomplish within the context of a universal insurance program than they will be in a kind of broken up and complicated system of the kind that we have right now. But Dr. Weissman's absolutely right that evaluation and management thinking kinds of services are under-rewarded compared to procedurally oriented services. That's not to say that proceduralists are earning more than they used to. Many of them are earning less, but they still are paid by national standards. If you look across incomes among many different occupations, they're still paid generously. Most Americans are not very sympathetic to the calls of physicians for more generous payment, because it looks to them, even for those physicians who are not well reimbursed, it looks to them like they make a fairly reasonable living, and the average physician income is well over $100,000, and that looks pretty good to most Americans. So I think there probably needs to be some redistribution within the pool of physician payment, because the ability to have your situation diagnosed and your care managed is still a critical part of the system, as well as the ability to get procedures done for you.
1-800-989-825 is our number. Let's go to Cleveland, Tennessee. Dr. Kyle, a radiologist.
Yes, thank you, Ira, for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
Well, the discussion has gone in several directions, some about malpractice crises, which are certainly true, and some about insurance crises, which are certainly true, and some about managed care crises, which are certainly true. And I've got some comments from where I see out here in my little trenches in East Tennessee. And I could make comments about all of them. I think that some of the more interesting things that have happened recently were a segment on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer a few nights ago. There was a physician, a trial lawyer's representative, and some folks from representing the insurance companies, and they were almost banding against each other. The trial lawyer representative trying to say, well, it's the insurance companies, and the insurance company saying, well, it's not, and the physician's representative saying another. And in my brief experience with it, well, not brief, but in my limited experience in 11 years of practice, I've seen some just incredible stresses put on excellent physicians. One case I can think of where the fellow was the chief of medicine, where I trained at UT Memphis, which did, by the way, teach us about nutrition 11 years ago. And he was just raked over the coals. And this guy was one of the best doctors I know. As a matter of fact, if my wife was sick in the ICU, I would want this guy on her case. And he was so ill, he could barely practice medicine. He actually vomited during the case, and after a long, arduous, confrontational trial, he was found innocent, and the case was thrown out. And that's the kind of things that doctors, in my experience, are facing in the real world, and I think unjustly so. And I think that it should be mentioned that the $250 cap that President Bush mentioned the other day in the State of the Union address is toward non-economic damages. And what that means is, if you have an incompetent physician and he makes a mistake and kills your 35-year-old CEO and he has a $10 million potential, well, you can still sue for that $10 million. It's just that you can't sue for punitive damages to punish that doctor for over $250,000. And I think these very complicated, multifaceted parts of malpractice, managed care, should be examined extensively. And I think this is a great way to start doing it. I'd like to make one more comment, and then I'll stop and let everybody take off. And that is about the way that... Well, I've lost my train of thought. It was something really important I wanted to touch on. National health insurance. Just let me say this real quick.
No, go ahead. Take your time.
Okay, good. In Tennessee, we have the classic example of how not to do national health care insurance. It's called TennCare. And briefly, let me explain it. It is a disaster. A disaster. And if you ever look at it, pay close attention to it in the news. We are $311 million short, and our new governor, Phil Bredesen, is just really trying to find the money to dig himself out of the hole in which our state is placed, mainly because of our TennCare prototype national health insurance program, which has, of a state of 5 million people, 1.4 million people in this program. 1.4 million. And that is ludicrous. It started with a few hundred thousand, and now people are coming across the border claiming to live here, claiming to work here, and they don't. People are falsifying the system, abusing the system. There's no copay. In other words, when a patient wants to come in, to the doctor's office. They just walk in. I'm on 10 care. I don't pay any money. There's nothing to check them to make them think twice about coming to the doctor or walking to the emergency room. Even worse than that, last night I was in the ER. Half the night I was up doing things for people, and I don't mind it. I'm happy to do it. But when someone walks into the ER at 3 a.m. and is with a stuffy nose, a cough that they just can't wait to see someone else for, because it's most convenient for them, and they don't have any copay, they don't have any deductible, they don't have anything to keep them away from that, they will abuse the system as it is being terribly, terribly abused here. This happened in the early 1990s. I don't know how long our Medicaid waiver has been here from the federal government. I don't understand the waiver completely, but under Governor Ned McWhorter, this is what many people think. This is what I hear them saying. The doctor's saying, you know, I think that Mrs. Clinton came in here and this was her attempt at national health care. It is backfired.
Do you think if there were true national health care where you could, you know, every state, you wouldn't have to move around to get the health care you want? It wouldn't affect one state more than another?
Yes, I do. I do believe that. But it would have to be done equally. Yeah. And that's going to be difficult, and there have to be checks and balances in place, which there are not in 10 care, and that is why we have this terrible deficit, people abusing the system. There's no way to get out of it. We're all behind. Next year, we're going to be $500 million behind. And how can 1.4 million people be on this insurance program, which was meant for the uninsurable, because people are abusing it so terribly? Mm-hmm. And I hope for our country and our state that we can get out of this hole somehow. And Mr. Bredesen's got a hard task ahead of him. So I think I've talked probably enough.
All right. Well, you certainly made the point and raised awareness about it.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Dr. Kyle.
Thank you very much.
Let me just remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
I had a couple of thoughts.
Go ahead, Dr. Blumenthal.
First of all, the malpractice system in our country is broken. It doesn't protect people adequately against bad quality care, and it often unfairly accuses and punishes physicians who are not, in fact, guilty or have not been involved in any healthcare quality problems. What we need is a concerted effort to make a safer healthcare system, and that means working at every level of the system to make all the processes that go on in our system work better and perform more safely. A critical component of that is going to be improved information systems, which we're just beginning to get in place. But we need to look for systemic solutions, not solutions that punitively take on individual physicians the way the malpractice system does. The other point I wanted to make is about 10 care, and I think the 10 care experiment was really a noble experiment. It fell apart because it didn't have the revenue base within a single state to cover all the uninsured in that state, and because it's very hard, as you pointed out in your question, Ira, it's very hard for a single state to do this given the disadvantages that state will come across. It will have to raise its taxes, which makes it less economically competitive compared to other states that don't have any attempt to deal with the uninsured. And then it draws people from other states who don't have that advantage across the border. This problem has to be taken on at a national level, and all the best efforts at a state level will not be sufficient.
Well, we hear a lot of lip service about, you know, changing the healthcare system. Do you think we're making any progress?
We're making very slow progress. There's a much higher level of awareness of how difficult and complicated the problems are, but I think it's happening much more slowly than one would like to see.
Dr. Wiseman, you're a young doctor. Have you got the strength to fight this battle?
Yeah, I think we do, and actually I think medical students... I mean, if there is a silver lining to this whole managed care system, I think it is that medical students are saying, okay, we're going to work within someone's constraints. Let's see how we can influence this and make it the best constraints possible and how we can make sure to provide health care to the most people with the best quality. And it's made national health care not such an anathema the way I think it was when there was fee-for-service and doctors had full autonomy. I think the changes are coming, and I think that, again, this is a case where physicians need to try to take the lead. I'm tangential back to the whole issue of malpractice insurance. I was thinking of a time my husband was getting on a plane, and there were two pilots in front of us, and they were talking about a third pilot and how incompetent he was and how scary it was to fly with him. And we started quaking in our boots and wanted to say, who is that, and I hope he's not flying our plane. And my husband said to me, aren't there doctors like that you know? And I said, yeah, you know, we all know doctors who aren't necessarily the doctor that we would send our family members to. And again, I truly believe, and having been in a patient, that most doctors have integrity, work hard, are smart, and do the very best they can. But we need to also have an internal policing system, because I think once in a while we will run across someone who doesn't meet all those standards, and there needs to be a way for doctors also to take the lead in that, in addition to all the other things that we can do.
All right. That's the last word for today on this. I'm sure we'll be back on this issue. Thank you very much, Dr. Jamie Wiseman, private practice dermatologist in Austell, Georgia. She's also author of As I Live and Breathe, Notes of a Patient Doctor, an excellent book. I highly recommend it. Dr. David Blumenthal, physician and director of the Institute for Health Policy at Mass General Hospital Partners Health Care System. I'm professor of medicine and professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Med School in Boston. Thank you for taking time to talk with us today. And I know you went through some grief to get on the radio. Thank you all for doing that.
It was a pleasure.
You're welcome. Earlier, we just had our two guests this hour. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. If you have comments or questions, write to us. Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 36th floor, New York, New York, 10020. Surf over to our website. Leave us mail there. You can make comments about the show today. Also, pick up hints, and you also get the past editions of Science Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week from Denver, live on the air from Denver, the AAAS meeting. Come and join us in the studio audience. I'm Ira Flato in New York.